The talk I'm going to give this evening is based on something which I saw last night, because even though we're not allowed as monks to watch TVs for entertainment, every now and again somebody finds something, an interesting program or documentary, and they put it on some sort of disc or some of these memory sticks, and they send it over to our monastery, watch it on a computer. And what we saw last night, Ajahn Brahmada was given this little documentary, I think from Canadian television, of a debate between Tony Blair and Chris Hitchens on what is religion a force for good in our world. And of course, everyone would, hopefully you know that Christopher Hitchens, he's the person who wrote the best-selling books, such things as God is Not Great, and I think Religion is a Trouble, or whatever it was. But he is very much a great critic of modern religion. And Tony Blair, he just recently became a Catholic. So they were arguing with each other about the value of religion. They mentioned a few little things there which I thought were important to bring up here as a way of understanding what we're teaching here and bringing the external ideas of Buddhism, its force in this world, into one's own spiritual practice, to take the big picture and then internalize it for yourselves afterwards. And one of the things which Christopher Hitchens actually mentioned at the end, which really rang a bell with me, was he said one of his greatest criticisms of religion was it took away your critical faculties and it demanded you suspend your intelligence on the grounds of faith. And for many, many people in our modern world, I think that was one of the reasons why he said that intrinsically it's not a force for good in this world. And he was making a comparison because he was a lifelong socialist, and when he was very young he flirted with the Communist Party. And even though that communism has got a very bad name in many places in the world, he said as a young man that there were many very idealistic, hard-working, selfless, intelligent people who had these wonderful ideals of fighting the worst of our modern world, of the materialism, exploitation, not giving rights to our minorities at that particular time. Women, why they were called a minority, I don't know, because they're half the population. But things like gays and people who are on the edge of our societies, that they wanted actually to give these people rights to free them from any oppression. And they had a lot of ideals. But Chris Hitchens, he'd said that he abandoned his commitment to that type of socialism on the grounds that it demanded for success a subservience to a hierarchical dictatorial system. And he said that was exactly one of the same reasons why he abandoned his respect for religion, because to submit to a hierarchy meant suspending your critical faculties, suspending your intelligence, just to do what you're told because the people above you said it was good for you. And he saw that was a great danger. And just as it proved to be a great danger in some of the regimes which followed the communist model, he said it is also a current and past and future danger in authoritarian religions, which tell you what to believe and tell you what to do. And sometimes you're demanded to follow that path or else. A good example of that here in Nolamara Temple is bowing. Do you feel compelled to bow when you're in here? If you feel compelled to bow, I have failed in my job. You don't have to bow. You are most welcome in this temple if you never bowed once. Because there is no compulsion in a spiritual path which is really deserving of its name. There is no force, and you should never feel diminished to feel better or worse because you perform one ritual or you don't perform a ritual. Another example, the lady in the back over here somewhere, she came up to tell me earlier that she's got a terrible back, and so she finds it very difficult to meditate, even in a chair. cushions are hopeless. So she lies on her back when she meditates. Now, please, she was actually told off by someone a few weeks ago. Please, this is a compassionate place. And if a person needs to lie down, please let them lie down. And if they're misbehaving, it's their karma. Don't be a policeman. Don't be an authoritarian, because that is what spoils religion. So kindness and compassion is the best. It reminded me many years ago of this lady who came here, and she, not only, I did actually tell this lady, you can lie down, but please don't snore. Because, you know, sometimes people can really snore loudly. And so please don't snore. She said, no, no, I don't snore. But one day that happened a few years ago, that somebody came here. And this was some years ago, because we used to have chairs on this side and chairs on the other side as well. And they were sitting in the back over there. And they lay down and they started snoring. And somebody woke them up and just really gave them a hard time. And said, you know, you shouldn't do that. This is meditation. Sit up or something. If you can't sit down, you shouldn't be in here or something. And that, to me, was the worst of religion. What you really try not to have any part of in this organization. Because she told me beforehand that she was having such a lot of domestic violence from her partner. She was so scared. Now, obviously, when you have domestic violence, the best thing to do is go to the police, for goodness sake. But, you know, I've been around a long time, and sometimes just people just, they can't see that's the right thing to do. They endure. But there she was, and she came here, and she said this was the first place she felt safe in months. And so she was just felt so tired and worn out. Imagine you're in that situation. You're in a hell. You just don't know what to do and where to go. And you come to a place like this, which is kind, compassionate, and peaceful. She felt safe. Now, for many of us, we take that for granted. But for her, this was the first time in months she felt safe. So she lay down and she fell asleep. And what a wonderful service we can do to give that to people. And so waking her up, what do you do that for, stupid? Leave her alone. She was having a wonderful time. She felt safe. What a great gift it is we can do that for people. And so experiences like that just show me that when it's an authoritarian, this is the rules, this is what you have to do, this is what you must do, and we've taken away the reason why we have those rules in the first place, you know, for peace, for compassion, for wisdom, we're missing out what religion's all about. And this is what Christopher Hitchens was saying, that sometimes we're demanded to believe in some ancient book, we're demanded to believe what some monk actually tells us. And even if it goes against our critical faculties, if we're asked to suspend our intelligence, too many of you actually do that. Please don't do that. That is the dangerous, whether it's in politics, whether it's in religion. I don't know how many people are convinced to believe in what is unbelievable. And that's the first step of danger in our world. How many violence has been done in our world? Now, how much exploitation has happened simply because we believed it was all right? Why? Somebody told us. Who? It's either some big politician or some big figure or some religious person. Religion is never supposed to challenge your critical faculties. It's never supposed to subvert your intelligence. It's supposed to enhance your critical faculties, to teach you how to see more deeply, to be more intelligent, not less intelligent. And to be able to do that, we have all of these ways of training our mind to see clearly, but it does not mean we actually suspend our faith. So we suspend our judgments. Instead, we should suspend our faith. As I mentioned many years earlier, and this is one of those little sound bites. Even as a monk, I have to have sound bites, because when you give a talk, what do you actually remember? Just a few of these important little sayings. The two types of religion to be found in our world today. And this is not just one type of religion. This is against, this goes across the board. The religion which abandon the religion which changes the truth to fit the faith. and the other one which changes the faith to fit the truth. I think you understand what I mean. What religion actually are you following? Is it changing the truth to fit your faith? Buddhism says this. Christianity says that. That's what it said. These people know more than I do. Therefore, even though I know this ain't true, well, it must be true because they say it. So never actually do that, please. If anything which you hear here you don't agree with, wonderful, disagree with it. Never bend the truth to fit the faith. The other way around, bend the faith to fit the truth, to fit your experience, your understanding. Now this is not being a radical Buddhist. This is actually original Buddhism. I know that sometimes I get criticized by some quarters by saying that, you know, I like changing things, that I'm a rebellious Buddhist, that, you know, I am just a radical. But actually, I sort of confound people, saying, I'm actually one of the most conservative, fundamental Buddhists you can actually find. I actually follow what the Buddha said. Because that's what he did say. You all know the Kalama Sutta, I hope. The Buddha said, don't just believe because it's tradition. Don't just believe because, you know, it's been passed down for generations. Don't just believe because anyone says it. Don't just believe because your teacher said it. Don't just believe because, you know, the Buddha said it. But follow your experience. And after he taught the Kalama Sutta, what happened? Because the Buddha taught the Kalama Sutta, everyone believed it. Challenge it, for goodness sake. And that's one of the most wonderful things I found about Buddhism. That's one of the reasons I find it happy to be a Buddhist, because I could challenge anything. And please, you challenge whatever is said here. Never allow, this is another saying, never allow never allow sort of knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Because knowledge is all that you've been taught, all you've been here, all you've heard when you've come to places like this, all that you've read, all that has been imparted to you by others. And you know how often that can stand in the way of truth? Because truth is your experience, is your understanding of what's happening right now. And you know so often knowledge stands in the way of truth? That often happens, especially in things like science. In science, when we all know about sort of medicine, we all know about laws of gravity, we all know about the biology and botany, and some guy comes along and says, no, you're wrong, it doesn't work like that. And what does the scientific establishment say? You're a radical, you don't know what you're talking about, get out of here. And all the great advances in science, as we all know, were done by the radicals. And when they were first proposed their theories, they were considered, no, it can't be right, you're wrong. How often was it that the knowledge stood in the way of truth? And that also is in medicine as well. But I recall I don't know who this guy's name is, but this was a real good scientist. I was told this by this doctor who took me onto this retreat in Wat Buddha Dhamma many years ago. That's a monastery in Sydney. And as he was driving, he said, the professor who welcomed him to the medical school, I think it was Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney, med school, he gave the opening address to all the students to welcome them to the medical school. And the opening address started with these unforgettable lines. He said, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. Our trouble is we don't know which 50% it is. Now, what a great scientist that is. It is suspending knowledge so that any part of what we're teaching you here, any part which we're imparting to you as medical knowledge, it's not truth. Truth is something which you'll find later on. Nothing is unchallengeable. And that is basic Buddhism, which I really loved when I first found that out. There was another example. When a Buddha gave an inspiring talk, this was original Buddhism, 2600 years ago, he gave this inspiring talk and he turned around to his chief disciple, the monk who was the wisest of all the monks he had there, and he said, do you believe what I've just said? And this monk said, no, I don't. Now, what a wonderful thing that is. Imagine that happening, sort of in, say, the Catholic Church. The Pope talks to his cardinal. Do you believe what I just said? Cardinal said, no way. And this was actually praised. The Buddha said, well done, Sariputta. If you don't understand it, or if you don't sort of believe it, say so, be honest. Do not abandon your intelligence. Do not subvert your critical faculties. Now, I need to say that again and again, because many of you do subvert your critical faculties. Many of you do abandon your intelligence because you heard it from me. You heard it from a nun. You heard it from somewhere else. You read it in a book. Now, I want to take this spirituality to a higher level, because if you do have that belief and you do suspend your critical faculties, there's all sorts of terrible things will happen. And this is the worst part of religion, which people like Christopher Hitchens were actually emphasizing. You know, the abuse and killings which go on in the name of religion. Why? Because people believe in what they read in the book. They believe in what they've heard from the pulpit rather than understanding the truth in their own hearts. Understanding the truth in their own hearts leads me on to another part of what real religion is, and the worst part of religion. And if Buddhism is going to be a force for good in this world, the type of Buddhism we're looking at, the original form, because that understanding the truth in your own heart gives you an autonomy in religion, which means that you have to make your own choices. You have to decide for yourself what is true and how you're going to behave, and what is good and what is bad. Too often it's the religions actually tell you what's good and tell you what's bad. And therefore sometimes some religion says homosexuality is bad and it's evil. And I'm sure there's many homosexuals who are in this audience this evening or listening on the internet, and just how gross that is and how that hurts you. I will never forget this talk I gave in the Old St. Anne's Hospital. It was Mercy Hospital now, I think it's called. And after giving a talk, this elderly gentleman came up to me and he said, thank you so much for what you said about gays. He said, I'm a senior gay person in Perth. And he said, religion has been so cruel to us. And when he said that, it wasn't the words which I heard, it was the emotion which he'd had in his heart for maybe 30, 40, 50 years, because he must have been in his late 60s. And that really hurt me. I have enough empathy to feel other people's pain. And I thought, my God, what has religion done to you guys? Now, I mentioned it, I was never been gay. I was a heterosexual. I had girlfriends. Hopefully they'd never come and find me these days and tell me all the stuff I got up to. But, you know, I was heterosexual. But actually to hear that, I thought, what has religion done to you guys? And not only that, why did that happen? Because all of you, I'm sure you have a friend who's a gay, if you're not gay yourself. Why are they doing this? What's wrong with gays? Exactly. Believe your own heart. Believe your own experience. And don't just believe what some, you know, usually man, so probably the gay themselves, say from the pulpit. I get into trouble for this, but this is what we're supposed to do as monks. We're supposed to challenge. So, it's wonderful, isn't it, that you can actually have autonomy. And this is the other thing which Christopher Hitchens was actually mentioning, which I agree with totally. And I see this as a danger even in Buddhism. That the Buddha, when he set up Buddhism, he followed a democratic system. When people keep saying democracy started in Greece, I challenge that. That is just your faith, what you've been taught. That's another example of your knowledge. Yeah, we all know that, don't we? But do we? Is that true? It's very likely it's untrue. Because in the ancient Buddhist texts, which we've got no doubt are authoritative for 2,600 years ago, 2,600 years ago in India, this is about 150 years, 200 years before Socrates, there were old democracies, systems which had been developed, I don't know for how many years, the Buddha's own land, the Sakyan Republic. You know, all Sakyamuni, Sakya was his clan. That was a republic. They had an even bigger republic just north of the river Ganges, just north of Bondi Patna. That was the Wajian Republic, which was very, very strong, very long-lived, and it was so similar to the way that the democracy was happening in Greece. It wasn't a total enfranchisement of everybody. Number one, the women couldn't go into those meetings. Number two, like slaves couldn't. You had to be landowners. But the landowners, it was a democracy very similar to Greece at that time. And that was actually the system which the Buddha took on for the Sangha, for the monks and nuns. We're supposed to be autonomous. And that wasn't just a mistake. That was actually reflecting the whole teachings which he were giving on personal religious autonomy. An example of that, a very famous saying, Buddhas only show the way. They won't make you walk it. They will show you the way, and it's up to you. You have autonomy in your spiritual life. And whether you walk that path or you walk in the opposite direction, the Buddha would not criticize or praise you either way. He'd just respect you whatever you did. Otherwise, it's not autonomy. If you don't respect people's autonomy, it means there's some form of control there. And because there was no control from the very beginning, the way the Buddha actually set up the communities, the whole organization called Buddhism, it was totally autonomous. So every monastery, this was like the center of the Buddhist community, the monastery or the temple, that was totally independent of every other monastery in the whole world. You made your own decisions. Your community met together. And more than that, if any one member of that community objected, you couldn't go ahead. It had to be a unanimous decision. So you meet together. We do this right now, even in Bodhinyana Monastery, Dhammasara Monastery, they have to do the same. Any monastery which follows the old Vinaya, we meet together, we discuss whatever we're going to do. And if one monk objects, and then like say, Janarata, how many years have you been a monk now? 2 years. I've been a monk for 36 years. He's got an equal vote with me. That's unfair. And I did a proposal. I think we should have votes. How many years you've been a monk? I get 36, he gets 2. That doesn't work that way. We've got an equal vote. And that's actually the way that Buddha actually set it out. And it was an autonomous with harmony there. Now, that particular system is not just the way that the monasteries are run. That is the way that Buddhism is run. No hierarchies. But this great sense of equality and autonomy, which is why when you've come here, you've never been told, yes, you must keep the 5 precepts, or else don't ever walk in this door ever again. Sometimes I do tell jokes, and sometimes I get into trouble for that, because sometimes whenever we have these big festivals, which you see, and there's all this food, and you know, because there's these 8 precepts, when you keep 8 precepts, you can't eat in the afternoon. So I always say, look, all you other guys, you know, stay behind. Let the people with 8 precepts take the food first of all, because they have to wait too long. They won't be able to eat in time. So let the 8 preceptors go first. And then I say, after the 8 preceptors, the 5 preceptors go next. And then after the 5 preceptors, I say the 4 preceptors. Then the 3 preceptors, then the 2 preceptors, and the 1 preceptors. Anyone who's not keeping any precepts, you can't have any food in the Buddhist temple. That's just a little joke. But no, even if you keep no precepts, you're still welcome. Why is that? It's because we don't want to actually to control. Because that's what Christopher Hitchens was also alluding to. Whenever we get hierarchies, especially in potent things like religion, we get power. And we all know just that famous saying of Lord Acton. I always remember this because I was born in Acton. He was this old lord who had this big country estate. And actually that was the primary school. It was right where he had his country house. So Lord Acton, he said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's one of the reasons people like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, were so upset at religion. Why? Because it became organized. And with organization came power. And with that power came inevitable corruption. And this is why I really ask the whole Buddhist world, please, don't have too many hierarchies. Don't too many big organizations. It's even if they're made up of good monks, the very fact you're trying to control a set of monasteries means you will always get corrupt. You'll always make stupid decisions. Why? Because that's the nature of power. It corrupts. The Buddha obviously saw that and kept everything autonomous. A devolution of power. Giving power to every monastery. From the monastery, power to every monk. Every nun had that power. Every lay Buddhist had that power. And there was no one who could tell you otherwise. There is no pope in Buddhism. There never had to, there never could be. Because one of the last sayings of the Buddha, these are little sayings which are not like sayings about, you know, which are nice aphorisms, you know, which you can put on your board, you know, just like I said, that never let sort of knowledge stand in the way of truth. Oh, that's very good. Now, this was a saying which many people miss, but which had a huge impact on world Buddhism. Just before he passed away, someone asked him, who's going to take over? Who's going to be the boss when you're dead? And he said, no one will be the boss. He said, let the teachings, let these rules for the monks, let that be your teacher from now on. No other teacher. Now that was a powerful statement. It meant he could have no lineage of leaders. You just let the teachings be your leader. What that did, instead of having this boss monk, this pope, this Sangharaja, this Mahanayaka, these are what has actually developed as Buddhism has lost its way. Sangharaja means the king of the king monk. Mahanayaka means the great leaders like you have in Sri Lanka. Instead of having that, the Buddha said, no, let every monastery be independent. Let every monk in that monastery be autonomous. Let every Buddhist find their own way. Here are the teachings. Here is the buffet. You choose what parts you want to eat and how you eat it. Now that's incredibly radical, but I find that so beautiful because in one stroke it stopped all the abuses which a hierarchy eventually perpetrates. Unfortunately, that people forget that. I know there is some downsides to having autonomy. It means it becomes a bit chaotic. Sometimes it takes a long time to make a decision in a monastery. I still remember the time when we were painting our dining room. It still got the same color. And I decided to let the monks choose. I got all these different colors from the painter and say, which one do you choose? And it was a democracy. Who got the most votes won? And most of the monks, they voted for this yellow color. And the painter hadn't finished painting maybe about half a wall when it became clear to everyone. You'd need sunglasses to go into that room to be able to survive. It was glaring. And so we had to tell the painter, stop. And he had to buy lots and lots of white paint, dilute it and dilute it and dilute it. He's got a reasonable colouring. It actually cost our Buddhist society $2,000 we lost for that. It was a big room. But sadhu, it was worth $2,000 to keep the principle that, you know, I knew what colour it would be. You know, I'm always right. That's the trouble with being a boss. But you had to let the system work because, yes, you wasted $2,000, but you're making this beautiful statement about autonomy, freedom, no hierarchies. Yes, some leadership, but leadership which doesn't make you do the way, which shows you the way and lets people go that way if they want to. And that's one of the reasons why Buddhism, if it's real Buddhism, has avoided many of the problems. But we do get the other problems. It is a bit chaotic sometimes. Maybe a bit of money is wasted, but I think it's beautiful that way. You've often noticed, I think those of you who come into some of our ceremonies, that they're chaotic. You know, it's, you wonder sort of, you know, where is things? What's happening? But it works somehow or other. And that's why I've said to many people, if you do not like organized religion, come here. This is disorganized religion. But it still works. And the reason why it works is because people have got good hearts. Yeah, it's true there's a few people who abuse the system and just, you know, do whatever they want. But okay, that's fine, you abuse the system. You know, you come in later on. I don't mind if people abuse that system. But it doesn't matter. The important thing is it's disorganized, it's on trust, it's on honesty. And that works. It gives this beautiful feeling. It's chaotic, but it's fun. And it's much different than actually being to a place where you're regimented, stand in a line. It'd be very easy because, you know, we teach in prisons and our monks have got to know many bhikkhus. It'd be very easy in the next big ceremony here, like Waisak, to ask, you know, a few of the bhikkhus to come and keep order in this place. And I'm sure you see these big guys in leathers. You will shut up. You will turn off your mobile phones. But that's not the type of Buddhism we want, is it? Isn't it much nicer that we ask people to turn off their mobile phones when they're meditating and a mobile phone goes off and no one gets upset or angry? That's the Buddhism I like. Never the idea that a mobile phone goes off and your person is thrown out and blacklisted. Your photo is taken, your fingerprints, and you're never allowed ever to come into a temple again. Now that's not Buddhism which I know. It's wonderful when we have this beautiful sense of compassion and kindness and openness. Yeah, your phone goes off. We all make mistakes. I make mistakes. We all do stupid things sometimes. That happen. And make peace with things rather than trying to control things. Because that is the heart of why Buddhism doesn't have hierarchies. Why it gives autonomy. Because the very idea of controlling goes totally against the core Buddhist teachings of liberation, freedom from suffering, and peace. In the same way, we don't control people when they come in here. I never control you in teaching meditation. Instead, what did I say about meditating? Just make peace, be kind, be gentle, no matter what's happening. Now, I know that there are some systems, some Buddhist communities, they are hierarchical. They do have an abbot who has total power. And they also have a meditation system, or even a Dharma system, where they teach you and you have to do examinations. And if you fail, you have to do it again. And they have a meditation where you have to sit up straight, cross your legs, don't even blink, and don't move until I've finished ringing the bell. Have you been to meditations like that? Some of you have. Now, it's not just counterproductive. It is un-Buddhist. It is just someone trying to control you and you trying to control yourself. And for many of you, you've been doing that all your life and you've reaped the results of that. Sickness, tension, lack of self-esteem, a lack of peace and meaning in your life. Or other people have tried to control you. And you know what that feels like. When you're being controlled, especially by a partner who you love, the relationship just gets so unbearable, claustrophobic. And maybe you may be that controller. Look at yourself. Your partner in life, do you love them or are you trying to change them? What is your relationship? Which is why when we teach this Buddhism, it's amazing just how relationships actually change from being dysfunctional to being truly loving. You're not controlling the other person anymore. You're letting them be. And then they become better. You control them and they get worse. You love them and they get better. It's counterintuitive, which is why we call it wisdom. Wisdom is something which you... It goes against your knowledge. Never let knowledge stand in the way of truth. It works, so use it. But more than that, the way that you meditate. For years and years and years, I've been telling people, just let things be. Stop trying to control your mind. Stop trying to tell it what to do. And that's one of the reasons Prem said all these monks who are listening to me teaching meditation in Sri Lanka, why many of them got the message. And why they're really happy, now they know how to meditate. Before they were told, watch the breath. So sitting here watching the breath, trying to watch the breath, getting nowhere, getting tense, and screwing up their minds. And Ajahn Brahm said, just let things be. You fall asleep, just let yourself fall asleep. Stop trying to control the mind. And many of those monks in Sri Lanka said, well, I'll just fall asleep. I said, yes, of course you will. Because you need to be asleep. You know the reason why you fall asleep in meditation? Because you're tired. It's nature. Stop fighting nature. Just be with nature. Your job is not to control nature, but to give even your mind autonomy. And I said to many of these even monks, I gave them the simile, which I give in meditation, of inviting a friend out for coffee. Say tomorrow afternoon, you have a free afternoon, and you ring out your friend, hey, let's go for a cup of coffee. And you tell your friend, now we're not going to go to Gloria G's, we're not going to go to Starbucks, we're going to go to Dome, okay? And when we go there, we're going to sit in the table, just in the corner, not in the front, because I like the one in the corner. You're not going to sit in the chair next to the wall, but the chair on the opposite side, because I like the chair by the wall. And you're not going to have a latte, you're not going to have a capo, you're going to have a sort of a short black. And you're not going to have a muffin, but you're going to have a biscuit. And we're going to talk about Buddhism, not about Christianity, because I'm a Buddhist and I don't care about your Christianity. We're going to talk for about 1 hour, and that's only 1 hour, because that's all the time I've got. And then afterwards you leave, okay? Now you get the message? That if somebody called you up, and they spoke like that to you, what would you say? Oh, I'm too busy, I'm sorry, I haven't got the time, I've got other things to do. You'd lie to get out of that, because who likes to be with a control freak who's always telling you what to do, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, where you're going to sit, and how long you're going to sit there for? That is unbearable. Now you know why you can never be at peace with your mind, because that's you. You are that control freak with your mind. Come on, mind, you're going to watch the breath now. You're going to watch the breath for half an hour. And then when Ajahn Brahm rings a bell, then you can do something else. And you're not going to watch it your way. You're going to watch it the way the monks say. And you're going to do this and you're going to do that. Now, many people treat their minds like slaves. They're control freaks. That is not Buddhism. Please give your mind autonomy. Give it freedom. And on these retreats, actually this was an earlier retreat, I think in the November retreat, which I gave at Jhana Grove or somewhere, I forget which, I give so many retreats. One of the problems actually with, I actually practice what I preach, living in the present moment. Sometimes I forget what month it is, what day it is sometimes, so it is Friday today, it must be Friday because I'm giving a talk here at Nolamara. But I do actually forget, really, seriously. Too much living in the present moment. But actually that's a danger, because I remember years and years ago, this was in our old Buddhist center. I'd always go off on tangents, but I love tangents because I'm totally out of control. Just like I don't control my mind, I don't control you. I'm not a control freak, so my mind wants to go off on a tangent. I let it go, off you go. But it's an interesting tangent, because this guy, about 25, 26 years ago, this was in our temple in North Perth. I even remember his name, Druba. He was a Nepalese guy. He had an epileptic fit in the back of our vihara, our temple. So we called the ambulance, and I was looking after him. And the first thing the ambulance said to this guy is what day is it? And I realized, I actually sort of got shocked by that, because I didn't know what day it was. I was just very glad they never asked me. Otherwise, they'd take me to the ambulance as well. So you're a monk. You're not supposed to know what day it is. You're supposed to be living in the present moment. So I have to be very careful. I think if I ever have an epileptic fit, I'll get my diary out quickly and check the day and before the ambulance man comes. But anyway, that's just going on a sort of a tangent. But on this retreat which I was teaching, I told this one fellow, I said, just when you get up in the morning, just ask your mind, what do you want to do today? Just give it some freedom. Give it autonomy. He had this most wonderful retreat. instead of forcing his mind and telling your mind, you're going to meditate, you're going to walk, you're going to watch the breath, you're going to sort of do metta meditation, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, he gave his mind freedom. He had wonderful meditations, really peaceful. Do you get the message? The whole of Buddhism, the core, original Buddhism, was about freedom, respect, kindness. Do you really respect your mind when you're meditating? Sometimes my mind needs to think. Okay, mind, off you go, think. Sometimes my mind needs to go to sleep. So off you go to sleep, mind. I respect my mind. I don't control it. No more than the Buddha controlled his monks or his laity. That is a way of peace. That is a way of harmony. It's really weird, but whenever you try and control things, it always goes wrong. There's an old friend who's come, I haven't seen her for years. She's a nurse. I hope you've heard this teaching, because this has actually really, really helped so many people. In Sri Lanka, this doctor-nurse couple, I know, two doctor couple, they said, we heard this teaching, that just changed the whole way we actually do our jobs. And that was a teaching that the job of a nurse, the main priority of a doctor is not to cure the patient. Any doctors here, please stop trying to cure the patient. That's not your job. Your job is to care for the patient. Now, this is not a small thing. That totally changes your attitude. You're not curing them, that's trying to control the disease. And you know what happens sometimes? Many doctors, nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists feel just so upset when the cure doesn't work. They feel failures. And I mean, that's no small thing if you're treating sort of maybe a small kid, you know, 10, 11 years of age, and you have to go and face the parents when he dies. And you feel a failure. And a failure because you've misunderstood your obligations as a doctor, as a nurse. Your job was never to cure that boy or that kid. Your job was to care for them. And if you realize your main job is caring, you will never fail. You can always care for a person. But sometimes you can't cure them. But you can always care. You know what happens? If you care for people, you tend to actually get a far higher cure rate. You understand why? It makes sense, isn't it? Now you point it out. The reason is because some of the interventions of medicine are just so aggressive. They're obviously going to contribute to greater sickness, even death. Because it's not just a body, it's the mind is really important in an illness. If you care for a person, it has a huge beneficial therapeutic effect, as you all know. If you get a visit from somebody in hospital, you feel really down, you feel very sick, someone is caring about you. It helps. It improves your chances of recovery. That's why they have things like pet therapy in hospitals. A little dog comes by. I know dogs are great about caring for you. They just look at you, whoever you are, and they just wag their tail and lick you. Even if you don't deserve to be licked, they'll still do that for you. They're totally unjudgmental. They care. And of course, that gives a huge uplift to the person who's laying in the bed feeling like death, so uncomfortable, so in pain. You understand how care is a powerful medicine. Which is why, if you remember, your job is to care rather than cure, you'll be a far more successful medical practitioner, far more successful nurse, psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor, whatever else your job is in life. But you can also see why, underlying that caring rather than curing, is underlying not being a controller, not trying to force the issue of life and death. Which is what sometimes doctors feel they are. They are little gods with the power of life and death in their hands. No one deserves that power, not even a god. You only you have that power. All we can do is to care. And if we know how to care, we understand what our obligations in the spiritual life is. Not to control, but to care. The job of a monk is not to control you, but to care for you, to show you kindness, no matter what you ever do. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to practice. Yeah, you tell me my teachings are wonderful, the best teachings ever. Oh, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Or you tell me the teachings are bullshit, or whatever else it is. And I say, wonderful, very good. Now that's actually what we really mean about caring, not controlling. Caring, giving, letting things be. Not craving, not controlling. You all know that craving, controlling, you should know anyway. Basic teachings of Buddhism, the first teaching of the Buddhas and the Four Noble Truths, craving, controlling leads to suffering. And that was a core teaching. He understood this. The first thing he understood was that control is the cause of the problem. Craving, wanting, and letting things be, being kind, being gentle, that is the cause for the end of the problem. So whether it's in the small things in your life, whether it's in your meditation, that's why recently I was teaching people and I said there's two types of meditation. That's right, teaching some people who came to monasteries or somewhere, I forget where. I said there's two types of meditation, and straight away they thought, yes, samatha vipassana. Actually it was in Armidale the other night. I said, no, that's not the two types of meditation. The two types of meditation is Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. So what the hell is that? So this is what it is. You all know Second Noble Truth, craving leads to suffering. So want. I want to be peaceful. I want to be with the breath. I don't want to be sleepy. I want this, I want that. What happens in your meditation? Suffering. You get tense, you don't get any peace, and it becomes a waste of time. Why? Because you weren't doing the right type of meditation. You were wanting something. Third Noble Truth meditation, the third Noble Truth in Buddhism is letting go of craving leads to nirvana, to peace, to freedom, to happiness. Letting go of craving. So when you're meditating, if you let go of craving, you find your mind is so peaceful and so happy and so free. That's the first teaching the Buddha ever gave. And people forget it. So when they're meditating, yeah, I've got to be peaceful, I've got to be still. Okay, full lotus, I'm going to do half an hour. What? And I want sort of jhanas, I want enlightenment, I want to see the Buddha, I want to see my past lives, what? Now those of you who've done that, you're laughing because you've done that before, haven't you? And you know what it feels like. Suffering. Stupid. Second Noble Truth you've been doing. Third, let things be. If I'm sleepy, I'm going to be sleepy. I'm not going to cure my defilements, I'm going to care for my mind. So don't be like that person who wants to cure all of your problems. In other words, change your mind. Care for your mind instead. That's something you can always do. And that's why you can always meditate. That's why Buddhism never had this controlling from the very beginning. Never had the hierarchies, which usually end up as patriarchies. Or even matriarchies were just as bad. Look at Margaret Thatcher. She tried to do the very best, but it just doesn't work. That's why if ever I'm the boss of everything. Okay, sometimes we make the joke. My official title in this organization is Spiritual Director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And sometimes people made the joke, I forget who it was, Spiritual Dictator of the Buddhist Society. Please, if I'm ever a dictator, please kick me up in the backside. Even though I'm a monk, please do that, because that's really dangerous and I never ever want to do that. Because that goes totally against everything I understand about Buddhism. And if that's the type of Buddhism which we're encouraging here, that will never be a danger to this world. That will never be responsible for homophobia, never be responsible for racism, slavery, never be responsible for any type of diminishing of any human being, because that all comes about when we try and control, we try and compare and make ourselves better or worse or whatever else. We're not curing anything, we're caring. We're not controlling, we're respecting. Which means the idea of hierarchies just disappear. Yeah, we do have a committee, but they change every year. Just like that old joke about politicians. Politicians are like nappies. They need to be changed regularly. So do committees. And we're having an election soon, so please, you nominate. So we can have a change. So not all the same people. Because it's dangerous if the same old people are every year on our committee. It's not that much hard work. And it's a lot of good karma. So if you haven't been on a committee yet, you get on that committee. So see how this place is run. And make sure we never, ever become control freaks in this society. Yeah, it means we lose a lot of power being able to, because when there's control, we can have organization, we can get things done straight away, we can do all this amazing stuff. But I hate that. That's dangerous. Much better that we're more slow and insidious in the way we work. In other words, you just get into people's minds and heads, and it works that way. And if we've got a good message, it will get out. We don't need to control people. We suggest things, and if it works, you'll follow it. You don't need to tell people or order people. You just make suggestions, that's all. And that's actually how the way we've worked. If it's a good suggestion, it will work. If it ain't, it won't. When we do it that way, we find that there's no control. There's another really good article. This is actually the Hitchens and Tony Blair debate. I'm sure you can find it on the internet. The other interesting little piece of which has come out in our monastery recently, that somebody sent us this speech by Professor Richard Gombrich of Oxford University in Thailand, just in, I think, September, October, about sort of the failure of Theravada Buddhism, that's our type of Buddhism, to disseminate its message, especially in the Western world. And it's a brilliant essay. And I say this, and it's very rare for me, because I went to Cambridge to praise someone from Oxford, but I've got to take my hat off to this guy. He really sort of nailed it on the head. That because of controlling, especially from sort of Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, you know, these are the strong Buddhist countries in our world, that we've actually haven't really exported Buddhism. We've exported Sri Lankan culture, Thai culture, Burmese culture. And we haven't actually given sort of the autonomy to those satellite monasteries in the different countries. They're giving a good example. Apparently, I never knew this, the London Buddhist Vihara over in London, the Sri Lankan temple, which was one of the first in the West, founded by the Mahabodhi Society, still it is controlled by trustees living in Sri Lanka. And that's one of the reasons they can't actually get charity status and why it hasn't really taken off. You can't have your controllers in another country. What do they know about the needs of, you know, the little society, you know, in London? And it's the same autonomy. What is that when you actually you give different states devolution of power? This is what happens when we have a Vatican over in Italy controlling what happens in Iceland or in Australia. I mean, what do they really know what goes on here? And it means they just get totally out of touch. And instead the Buddha was brilliant. Say, give autonomy. Yeah, we've got the basic rules, the basic teachings, you know, which are very, very good anywhere, but sort of don't have control from outside. Otherwise, Buddhism will never develop in our different countries. And you know all this. One of the reasons you come here, because sometimes what gets exported is just the culture, not real Buddhism. And sometimes it gets so overlaid with culture. It's like a cake with so much thick icing. You can never actually get to the cake. And for many people, that's what happens. So, take away the culture. Get to the heart. The original teachings of Buddhism, kindness, compassion, care, peace, very simple to understand, and that's what really takes off. And one of the reasons this Professor Gombrich mentioned this, he said, because like me, sort of when you first look at Buddhism, it's just a beautiful message. It makes so much sense, it's so liberating and so peaceful, and my goodness, it works. You get incredibly peaceful and wise, and many of your problems and difficulties just vanish. He said, why is this beautiful message encumbered by all this tradition and stuff which, you know, we think you have to do. So in this particular temple, we try and keep as much tradition, as much ritual away as we possibly can. Try and keep it simple. Get to the heart of the matter. And that's the only way it can really sort of be disseminated. But you know, it's the ritual which is the tools of control by people. Whenever there's a ritual, there's only some people who can actually do that ritual. Sometimes even now, if you want 8 precepts, you think you have to come to a monk for that 8 precepts, or 5 precepts. No, do it yourself. Go in front of a Buddha statue, determine the 5 precepts. You don't need it from a priest. This is not priestcraft. If you want to do well in your life, don't come and get a blessing from me, or this holy string, or holy water. I don't mind giving holy water, because it cools people down, especially in this weather. I did a lot of holy water, and I even did it to the monks, because they were getting a bit hot in the sala. It's very nice. But you take responsibility, rather than thinking a priest or a monk can do that for you, which is the teachings of Buddhism. Powerful, but very beautiful. And that way that Buddhism can be disseminated in this world. He also mentioned the bhikkhuni issue as well. He said, look, if women want to become bhikkhunis, they should be allowed to. Now, why are men stopping them? He said, that just now really hurts the growth of Buddhism in the Western countries. And it's ridiculous, it's stupid. What are you doing that for? So it's a beautiful article. So if you really want to see the rest of that article, Professor Richard Gombrich, it's the Oxford University Center for Buddhist Studies. Nice one to read. And so it's challenging. The last thing which he said in his article, actually the first thing, he said, Buddhism, like all religions, should not just be about comforting people, not telling people what they want to hear, and holding their hand and said, you're going to be all right. It's challenging people. Challenging people to look deeper. Challenging people to make the most daring step in your life. And take autonomy. Take charge over your life, over your karma. Rather than giving that authority to another person. Instead of asking me to decide. You take control. You be an owner of your karma. For many people, that's the most scary thing to do. We still want a mummy and daddy to tell us what to do. Some big mummy or daddy in the sky who revealed a book many years ago which gives us all the instructions of what we want to do. Thank you, mummy. Thank you, daddy. No, there is no mummy and daddy. You're adults. You're grown up. Take responsibility. Make your choices. Follow your path. Have autonomy. Gain your freedom. Otherwise, you'll always be a slave. A religion should not be enslaving, but should be liberating. I'm not here to give comfort. Religion is here to challenge you to be free. Thank you for listening. Thank you. Very good. When he was clapping, did you feel like you wanted to clap? If you didn't, why not? If you want to, do it. But you don't have to. Take autonomy. Okay, yes. At the back. Yeah. I get your message that he was saying this is for the camera because sometimes you can't pick up the questions on the recording. He was saying in the pedestal on which is a big statue of the Buddha, the entrance to this temple, is inscribed there a very, very famous message of the Buddha, Sabbapapasakaranam kusalasu pasampadasa chittam pavyodapalang etam buddha sasanam. Which, that's not what it says on there, that's Pali. But the second word was not to do any evil. I wanted to put not to do unskillful actions, which is much more accurate. Unfortunately, unskillful actions doesn't fit on the pedestal, but evil does. So I lost that. So just practical reasons, that's why we put it on there. But I agree with you, there is no such thing as evil in Buddhism. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'll put an extension coming outwards. Ask a question. That's a very good one, yeah. Yeah, it's a really good idea of yours, Lawrence, and I think really that by such a good idea you show you're very, very capable of being on our committee next year. So I think I should nominate you. And then actually you can get things done. Yeah, well, that's where we discuss things, on a committee. So the nomination... So the nominations, so I will sign your nomination form this evening. That's what, you know, that's one of the rules we have in a monastery, and I told people in Sri Lanka, they thought this was a great rule to institute. In our monastery, if anyone has an idea... they have to do it. So if anyone says, well, I think we need a shelf in that cupboard, they have to be the one who makes it and puts it up. So, you know where I'm going on this one, Lords. Very good. Excellent. Yes, another question over there. Yeah. Okay, when you do meditation, you're overcoming doubt. And is that a contradiction, having critical thinking? Not at all, because I use a simile of like doing a science experiment. When you're doing a science experiment, you're doing the experiment, you collect the data, you suspend your critical facilities for the time being, because you've got to collect the data. If you start judging the data in the middle of the experiment, the data which comes afterwards, you will distort the nature of the human mind. Things which don't agree with the conclusion you've arrived at halfway, you'd ignore. Anomalies or readings were taken wrong. The ones which support your conclusion you made halfway, you will keep. So in science, the way I was taught, when you're collecting the data, no critical faculties at all. This is not the time for it. And once you've collected the evidence, then you apply your critical faculties, but not while you're collecting the data. Meditation is collecting the data. Afterwards, when you come out afterwards, then you use your critical faculties. What was that like? How did that work? Why did it was successful? Why wasn't it successful? That's the time to use your intelligence. And also you will find that your critical faculties will be enhanced by meditation. You'll become a much clearer, deeper thinker, which is one of the great advantages. So meditation is never intended to dull the mind or to make you stupid. It makes you more sharp, more intelligent, and better able to use your critical faculties like a surgeon with a sharp knife. So thank you for that question. Okay, I will. Okay, last question, and then we'll end it because we're going over time. Yes? Oh, great. Yeah. Yeah, I know this one, but please tell us. The boil hell out of the water. Yes, that's how you make holy water. It was only that easy to boil hell out of water. But anyway, that's very good. Thank you for that joke. How do you make holy water? Boil the hell out of it. Very good.